You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in our region and beyond. Today, I am joined by one of my favorite historians, Beth Lou Williams, to discuss her recent book entitled John Doe Chinaman, A Forgotten History of Chinese Life Under American Racial Law. Beth, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I wanted to start out by saying that this book follows your 2018 book, The Chinese Must Go, which is a very comprehensive telling of Chinese exclusion, its progression and impacts, and really how it's been oversimplified or misunderstood by many scholars who haven't really fully interrogated how nuanced and targeted the immigration laws were over time. And in this new book, you frame the chapters with terms like coolie, criminal, alien, Chinawoman, invader, and predator, immigrant. And I'm wondering if the idea or impetus for writing this book and thinking about this book came out of some of the really heavy and loaded language that you came across when researching your last book.
I think that this book definitely came out of the last book. What I was trying to do in that book was to talk about, you know, how did Chinese exclusion, so the series of laws that barred Chinese immigrants from coming to the United States, started in the 1870s and 80s. Why did those come about? And I really wanted to interrogate how local actions, local violence pushed forward those laws. It was a book that was very much focused on the border, right? How violence in local communities pushed for border control. And it was a book that was very focused on really an unprecedented moment in the 1880s when there was unprecedented violence and expulsion of Chinese immigrants on the West Coast from local communities. And so the main way that these two books are connected is that finishing up a book, you're always dissatisfied with something. I felt like there was a lot to the story that I had learned along the way, spending time in archives, but not managed to convey in that book. You know, I wanted to move from the border to the interior. You know, what was daily, everyday life like for Chinese immigrants? And that's where, you know, I think that some of these loaded terms, coolie, China woman, criminal, come into play. And then I also just wanted to talk about this everyday life and how law did not only affect Chinese immigrants who were trying to enter the country, it also affected them on a daily basis as they just tried to live and work in the American West.
Yeah, and in order to really think about that, you had to gather a lot of information. And I was really interested to read about how you compiled all this national data. With the Oregon Chinese Diaspora Project, we've made an Excel file of all the local, state, and national laws we could find here in Oregon. And I can share it with you, and you can tell me ones we missed. But it was a big, and it's still ongoing, undertaking. So just thinking about the scope of what you gathered for this book, and at one time, this would have been beyond the scale of one researcher, or maybe would have taken your whole career. But can you tell us a little bit about how you can get more aggregate data because of how many different research source avenues have been digitized?
You know, it's one thing to try to count Chinese exclusion laws. There's only so many at the federal level that barred Chinese immigrants. But when you go into the local level and try to ask, you know, how were Chinese people's lives impacted by American laws? There's a lot of laws, right? You've got laws at the state level, all the Western states, and you've got laws at the level of the municipality. I started out doing this the old-fashioned way, and it sounds like you guys have been doing a lot of that work too, looking at books of statutes, looking at what historians have found in the past, because there's a lot of people that have been interested in these local laws. But ultimately, what I did was I teamed up with Hannah Postel, who at the time was a graduate student here at Princeton with me and is now a faculty member in public policy at Duke University. And we decided to use big data digital methods to really tackle this question, because increasingly, you know, statute books, even city level documents of laws have been digitized. And that means that we can do things like say, okay, let's get every single law that was passed in Oregon, or every single law that was passed in Portland, and then take those digitized files, make essentially giant spreadsheets of every single law, And then search them for key terms that we know are associated with the Chinese. Some of these really clear terms like Chinese, coolie, Chinaman, Mongolian, things like that. But also things that are associated with the Chinese more broadly, like opium or prostitution or carrying baskets on poles. And so we were able to get the most comprehensive count of laws that targeted the Chinese and laws that affected Chinese people's lives in the 19th century. You know, looking at basically 1850 to 1920, we found more than 5,000 laws
Oh my
that would have
gosh.
affected Chinese immigrants' daily lives.
So you're using AI for good, sounds like. But
Yes, it can be used occasionally for
yeah,
good.
good tool. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the ways you captured some of the laws that indirectly targeted Chinese Americans, the behavior-based laws. And here in Ashland, we had a soap tax, which targeted Chinese laundries. And many of these laws might never be clocked as the racist and discriminatory acts that they were intended to be, because they were targeting this population and they contributed to this matrix of oppression that folks had to navigate daily.
So when I say that there's more than 5,000 laws, it's important to note that these are different kinds of laws, right? So what we did was eventually we decided to that these laws really fell in three buckets, right? A bucket that was identity-based laws, so laws that really that name the Chinese or name aliens or non-citizens. Another bucket was what you said, those behavior-based laws. These are laws that, you know, were based on stereotypes about Chinese behavior. And so they targeted the Chinese indirectly, sometimes not naming them, but definitely passed in order to control their behavior. And they became really popular as a way to regulate the Chinese through these sort of supposedly race-neutral laws. The 14th Amendment says that people should have equal protection. And so knowing that the Chinese were associated with laundries, you know, in the West Coast, we see lots of laundry laws. Sometimes it would regulate a particular body of water that was adjacent to Chinatown. Sometimes it was about regulating work in a laundry at night, because Chinese often would work multiple shifts, both day and night. In San Francisco, there's, you know, a fairly famous law that regulated laundries that were in wooden buildings as opposed to brick buildings. When lawmakers were passing these things, they were very explicit about what they were doing, but the laws themselves were indirect. And I think it's really important, if we're going to try to understand what it was like to live as a Chinese person at this time, that to get a sense of these laws as well. The last bucket is what we call general outcast laws. And these are laws that affected a lot of people, outsiders, outcasts of various kinds. So these are things like vagrancy laws that definitely would have affected African Americans as well.
You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today we are talking with Princeton historian Beth Lou Williams about her new book on the forgotten history of Chinese life under American racial law. You talk about how Chinese immigrants and Chinese Americans were excluded, but you also talk about this idea of conditional inclusion and how that can look differently in different places. But that was particularly interesting for me, and especially when thinking about my work in rural Oregon, where Chinese American men and women were included in many aspects of community life, but not always on their own terms. So can you talk a little bit about how you think about that conditional inclusion?
Yeah, I know that this sounds like a bit of jargon, but it really became an important sort of keyword in my book. I think often when we talk about Chinese immigrants, we use the term exclusion, right? Focusing on that border control that Chinese were not allowed into the country. But in this late 19th century moment, there's more than 100,000 Chinese that were in the American West. There are large portions of cities and towns, especially on the Pacific coast. So their Chinese are there, right? And so many of these laws are not actually about excluding the Chinese. A lot of them are about, you know, okay, they're here, let's make use of them. So some of these laws are about exploiting Chinese labor, and a lot of laws are about, you know, keeping the Chinese out of positions of power, out of their ability to participate in democracy. So they're unable to vote. They don't have access to public records, things like that. This term, conditional inclusion, is trying to capture that, right? That the Chinese are included in these communities, but under what conditions? Often these conditions mean they're included as long as they stay in the correct job and live in the correct neighborhood and don't engage in particular activities.
Yeah, and those laws too, the way that they were circumscribed, I mean, I think that's really directly responsible to why a lot of these areas had huge populations of Chinese immigrants historically have zero descendants today because of the way they could participate. They couldn't build generational roots because of some of these parameters. So let's talk about names. This is a huge topic, and I know that you discussed some of the reasons why names weren't transcribed or mistranscribed, and also the results of these omissions. And that can be, you know, for historians and archaeologists trying to track people over space and time. But I wanted to kind of ask a little bit more about what it means to you when you think of the many men and women who have been anonymized in the historical records, and especially in contexts where their neighbors were not.
I chose to name the book, maybe a slightly provocative name, like John Doe Chinaman. And that term comes from the sources, right? I encountered a lot of sources, not just, you know, newspaper reports or things like that, public writing, but legal sources. So that is court documents or political investigations, things like that, that name the Chinese not as individuals, but as these sort of John Does, that a John Chinaman or a John Doe Chinaman. This really struck me in the archives that it's just very difficult to track an individual Chinese person's life because of these ways in which, at the time, they were sort of forcibly rendered anonymous. I mean, one of the examples that I like to use is out of California, right? The first census in California was in 1852. And in San Francisco, when they ran the census, they found, you know, 2,000 Chinese people, but they only wrote down about two dozen individual names. Everyone else was just simply listed as Chinaman. And I think that this, you know, sort of grouping that the Chinese were seen as an indistinguishable mass, that they were outsiders and that they weren't even necessarily seen as individuals is really linked to the then sort of lawmakers and the public sort of treating the Chinese as a mass, as a group of people that were unwanted rather than, you know, the neighbors that they truly were.
Yeah, effective otherization. And on that note, there are lots of facts and details and information and charts, which I love in the book. But there's also these moments when you kind of ask us to shift our gaze. And I'm thinking about there's a couple of prompts. Rather than think about, in this case, his children in historical photos, you wonder what life looked like through their eyes. And I thought this was really an interesting exercise, not only in considering and remembering the humanity of the people we study, but also it really gives space for them to be the arbitrators of their own experiences. So I wanted to just ask you a little bit about that and the way that you think about some of these images in your book and the way you want us to think about them.
And my book includes a lot of images, and it's tricky to include images of the Chinese, in part because so many of the images of the Chinese at the time, you know, were taken by white photographers or drawn by white illustrators. And so they involve, you know, often sort of a racist gaze in them that further otherize the Chinese. And so I call on the reader when I start out the book to try with me to, instead of sort of just looking at the Chinese in this book, but to try to sort of see through their eyes and imagine the world. This is a really difficult thing to do. I struggle with it. I think the reader, you know, has to work hard to do this with me. It's difficult because there's just so few sources from Chinese perspective. But one of the things that I found most powerful is a you know, a group of oral histories that were taken in the 1920s. And this is often, these oral histories were taken at the time with a lot of old timers, you know, people that had been in the United States, Chinese who had been in the United States for decades. And looking back, they talk about life and really give us a sense of, you know, could you walk into a restaurant? Could you walk into a barber shop? What happened if you asked a white man to cut your hair? What happened if you moved into an area other than Chinatown? How did you get your children into school? Could your children actually go to school? I use these oral histories to try to get a sense, from the Chinese perspective, what it meant to sort of navigate life in the American West.
That's amazing. And that wraps up this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. If you want to hear more from Beth like I do, be sure and go to your local independent bookstore and pick up John Doe Chinaman. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Show producer is Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and many more wherever you get your podcasts.